Steph Reed. I am the director of the Flat River Community Library.
I'm Cara McGee. I work at the Circulation Desk.
I am Michelle Howard, and I am the library director at the Traverse Area District Library in Traverse City, Michigan.
Welcome to the Flat River Front Porch. I've just been thinking this whole time that Sharon is going, I'm turning you into one person. I don't know faces or names. I just sit in my office and type things. Spreadsheets. That's my job. Just spreadsheets all day. You don't want to host this time?
Good.
Okay. Okay. All right. You're not the performer, apparently. So I am, once again, having the opportunity to geek out with our resident comic gal. Comic gal, yes. With Cara. And so I'll go ahead and introduce yourself again.
Again, I'm Cara McGee. I work at the Circulation Desk here, not to be confused with Cara, who also works up there.
Eventually, you're not going to have to say that anymore.
I feel like I tell apart because I'll have weird hair.
Well, yeah, you don't look anything alike,
no.
Definitely. It's a name only. You are not twinsies.
We like a lot of the same stuff, though.
Right.
You wouldn't think, I feel like, looking at both of us side by side, but, like, she likes stuff like One Piece and stuff like that just as much
as
me.
Well, I mean, comics bring us together.
Exactly. I was going to say, like, I'm definitely not the only comics gal at this library,
no.
Which is great.
As we've talked about before, we are big, hardcore comic people, generally speaking, so you found a good home, definitely.
Yeah.
There's never any shortage of comic stuff to talk about. So what's new in your world?
I feel like there is a lot going on right now, especially particularly right now. I'm getting ready to fly out to Seattle for Emerald City Comic Con this coming weekend, which is probably my biggest show of the year, other than like San Diego Comic Con, which I don't table. Usually if I ever go, because it's a very overwhelming show.
Oh, okay. So what do you typically do then?
At San Diego, I will, if I have new stuff coming out that year, I will usually go to my publisher's table and have a signing, or whatever their scheduled signing or, whatever else. I'll do panels every so often.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's the one con where I get to actually walk around.
Yeah, I was gonna say that sounds like way more fun. Like just being stuck at a I've gone to other events where there's been exhibition floors and I've done table work before and it is monotonous.
It is a grind. Yeah.
So it's the day job of comic people,
honestly.
Yeah,
basically. It was until I started working here, it was like the one time a month get out of the house and interact with people. You know, living in Greenville, especially where I am, where my neighbors are limited, I guess. It's nice to like go to the conventions and talk to like hundreds, if not thousands, of people over 3 or 4 days and then come back here and like hide in the woods, basically.
Right. You're reminded from time to time what the boundaries of typical human conversation is.
Yep.
When you have those moments where you finish saying something and the other person is just sitting there trying to absorb whatever you just said, and you have that moment, you're like, oh, right. Okay. So there's that boundary.
Yeah.
What I'm
like, am I talking like a normal person?
Right. Yeah. You have to be reminded from time to time, I suppose. I'm curious. I don't know if you know the answer to this. Is there a particular reason why Seattle is called Emerald City Con? Like, is there...
Seattle, I don't know the reason for it, but I know... The nickname for Seattle is Emerald City.
Okay, well, that's just my lack of cultural knowledge then. Okay.
And I only knew that, you know, after I'd been doing the con for a while.
West of Denver. Wait, is that true? No. I think technically Mesa Verde was the farthest west, but that's still Colorado.
Right.
So, yeah, that's...
Love Mesa.
Yeah, I'm very excited because I'm going to the ALA in San Diego this year, and that's going to be my official finally hitting that west coast, but... I mean, I'm a Midwesterner by birth.
I love Seattle. One of my favorite things about doing this convention, and one of the reasons I do it every year, other than it's a really good show, is it's like right down the street from Pike's Place Market, which is like where they do the fish throwing and all that. And the food there is so... Oh my gosh. I'm already in my head. I have a list of things I know I want to eat while in Seattle.
Do you ship stuff back?
Every so often.
Okay.
Every so often. I know this year I'm probably going to have to. Usually I can stuff stuff in my luggage and come back. But I have a lot of new merchandise and products and stuff with me this year.
Oh, yeah.
So I have no idea what it's going to look like traveling back. But I have a feeling I might have to ship some stuff.
I feel like there's that scarcity economy that comes with stuff like that, that you're like, in the moment, you're like, I'm going to want this in a month. I'm going to wish that I had eaten this. So I need to get all of this right now.
Yeah. And I've been very bad about that in the past because I do travel a lot. And one of the things I like to do or pick up whenever I travel is get regional foods and stuff like that. I'm a sucker for that. But then the problem is I get very precious about it and I feel like I hoard it and then I never use it and the stuff will go bad before I can use it. Cause I'm like, no, it's too good to like just used it casually, and I'm trying to be better about that instead of like saving things for special occasions. I'm just like,
so what kind of stuff are you getting that you're being precious about?
Stuff like, you know, dried pastas or like salsas and olive oil, stuff like that. As far as
something that you're not just sitting down with a jar of it and just eating it with a spoon, that sort of thing.
I went actually up to Sleeping Bear last weekend and stopped. I don't remember which Cherry Republic it was, but I definitely got like a char of like cherry queso. And I've just been like working my way through that the last couple of days. I'm like, this and not just let it sit.
Yeah. Food has become so decadent culturally at this point that we're just, I mean, too many things that we can get really excited about. And it stops being like, what I'm picturing is like Little House on the Prairie and, oh, I got an orange for Christmas. What a delight. And then, I mean, this is not an exact correlation because it was still in Grand Rapids, but I went to Downtown Market with my family on Saturday, and Downtown Market, they, you know, it's all of these different like food vendors and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, I need to get croissants. Oh, I need to get, I need to get pastries. I need to get soda. I need to get all, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then you get all these perishable foods and you're like, okay, well, I need to stuff all of these into my face right now because otherwise they're not going to get it eaten. It's like, oh, I just ate 4,000 calories.
Exactly. I do that. Again, yeah, this is me. Anytime I go to a city I'm familiar with for a convention, like later this year, I'm going to Atlanta for another convention.
Oh, okay.
And I lived in Atlanta for 10 years, so I have this whole...
You know the haunts, yeah.
I know the haunts. I've got all this these places I need to go back to and stock on food at and like get all my old favorite things from college. And the dangerous thing about Atlanta is there's this place down there called the DeKalb Farmers Market.
Okay.
It's this huge, like, warehouse size, like, international grocery market with, like, fresh, like, exotic fruits and spices and seafood. Okay. And, like, this huge, beautiful, like, international bakery inside of it. And I literally will just, like, after the con and before I, like, because I drive to this convention specifically to load up at this market on all these like breads, and like they've got this really great like European style deli, so I'll like grab like Russian style salamis and cured meats and stuff, and I'm like, this is fine, this is normal.
Yeah, like tourist eating like a tourist and like approaching it as like I have to do this all right now. It's a dangerous thing, and it reaches the point of not being fun anymore too.
Yeah, because you put a lot of pressure on yourself. It's like,
right,
if I, you know, I'm going to regret it if I go and I don't eat this and this and this. And like, there was a patron in here actually the other day. We got to talking, and she's from the Philippines originally and love Filipino food. And one of the things I'm very excited about getting while I'm in Seattle this weekend is there's a little stall in Pike's Market that does a salmon sinigang soup, which is like this tamarind based like rice vegetable soup. It's like very, very distinctive flavors, and I've had it like a couple of times, and it's been years since I've had it, and I've been thinking about this soup
for years. Never live up to your expectations
but I'm still gonna be real excited to go get it. I hope it lives up to my expectation.
Yeah, it's funny how food can like leave sense memories like this. I can still mentally sort of like taste this really amazing stew that I had in one of the hiking huts in the Alps at one point. It was one of those places where they don't have water heaters. In order to get supplies and stuff brought to the location. They have like baskets that come up because they literally, they are like an hour hike.
Wow. That's incredible.
But they had such good food there. And I think I was even a vegetarian when I had it, but I broke it just because I'm just like, I need to experience this.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, that was 20 years ago and I can still remember it.
I tell you what, one of my literal earliest memories, I lived in Germany as a little kid because my dad was military. And so probably
German food. Oh my gosh. It's underrated.
It's so good. And I vividly remember being at like maybe a New Year's celebration or something. I just remember my parents, we went to like this fancy party at a hotel for New Year's, and they served this like strawberry dessert that was almost like a creamy jello pudding consistency. Okay. Very, very specific flavor and consistency. And I was probably like 4 or 5. Uh-huh. And this has stuck in my head for like decades. And I've literally been chasing that flavor this whole, like, for years. Like,
did you ever figure out what it actually was?
I'm still trying to figure it out. Every time I'm at like a European style market or anything, I will like grab whatever like instant pudding mixes or jello mixes or whatever.
It probably doesn't even exist.
It probably doesn't. It might have just been like something I like my young mind came up with, right, or like maybe it was specific to that hotel or something. Is it like a blancmange or I don't. I'm determined someday to figure out what it was.
But you're going to have to find some like German pastry school to go to in order to learn the full breadth of the German dessert.
It might come to that. Actually, it's my white whale. That's strawberry dessert.
That's what it sounds like. Which is funny because you don't typically think of Germany as like a dessert.
Yeah. And it place. And it's possible that it wasn't even in Germany, honestly, because we, you know, Europe is so different that you can just take a like few hour drive and
that's
be
true.
In a different country. I know my parents used to do that. We used to like drive around Europe and just explore and stuff.
And I'm guessing that this did not have the same impression on them. It's not like you could ask your mom, like, do you?
I've asked her. She's like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay.
Like, yeah, it was, you know, I think I was just at the right age at the time that it like cemented.
Right. It was probably just like pudding.
Yeah.
Like
exactly. But it was so good. Someday I'll figure it out and I'll be so at, then I can die.
Right. And this is a really nerdy connection to make, but it's kind of like when you read books as a child, like, and when you form like really strong attachments to something that you really enjoyed reading when you were young.
Yep.
There's no point rereading it after a certain age, because at a certain point, you're just like, I'm never going to feel the way that I did when I read this the first time. Usually food doesn't have that sort of emotional response, but
so it's funny that you mentioned a book having that response, because I think like something similar actually happened to me on desk the other day.
Oh yeah.
Like somebody had brought back a stack of kids books, and including like the older Arthur books. And I never read those books as a kid, but the illustration style looked just like a book that I remember having read over and over, like in my mind. But it was like about a rabbit with like a brand new carpet.
Okay.
A very specific kids book. And I sat like at the computer and I was like, this has got to be the same illustrator that did that book. And
Mark Brown, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yep. And yeah, after some Googling, I realized, yeah, it was him illustrating a different writer. And I was like, thank God that just wasn't like the pudding dessert. I didn't like imagine this book. I thought about years until I saw that book come through.
And those books were so popular, I have to imagine that there was some, just like there is now in children's literature, there's some imitation that can come when particular illustrators have really popular books. One of the things that's really interesting to me, we talked a little bit about clickiness in the publishing industry, and I think there's a little bit of that with children's books now too, that they all sort of know each other, and sometimes author illustrators will illustrate their own books. Sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll illustrate other people's books. Sometimes they'll just write the prose, and then somebody else will. It's fascinating.
It's bizarre. I don't have as much, like, I'm not into that side of publishing as much as I used to be. Like I was saying earlier, I used to hang out with a lot of fantasy writers and stuff at conventions, and not so much anymore, just because like I feel like this is every industry. There's just so many cliques, and like you do get like the almost middle school, high school mentality almost with amongst them, and it gets exhausting. And I'm like, I can't. I'm too old for this. I just want to draw comic books.
I wonder if part of that is the core audience too. All of the children's authors and illustrators that I have, that I've had contact with, that I've, you know, been able to have personal interactions with, their vibe is much more like, this is just fun.
That's who you want. Yeah, that's who you want to work with. It's just people who are making books. Not so much because they're looking at what's popular and what their peers are doing. They're like, oh, so-and-so is making a book like this, so I've got to make sure I can have something to go against that. You want to collaborate with people who are doing it for the joy of doing it, for telling stories.
Yeah, and they get to do such fun stuff, too.
Exactly.
There's this really phenomenal, he occasionally will write his own books, but he's primarily known for illustration. His name is Christian Robinson, and he has this very distinctive style where he does a lot of sort of found object art, where it's sort of like paper piecing art. It's three dimensional, basically. His work is really, it's gorgeous. And so it's definitely worth checking out. But when I've interacted with him at conventions and stuff, he's so sweet, and he always seems like he's in a really good mood. And like, yeah, I feel like they get the more positive side of that world, such as it is.
Yeah.
But, I have a feeling that working with teenagers kind of tends to bring out a different side, maybe a little bit, but
knows. It's interesting. Like my personal experience doing YA middle grade books and stuff has always been super positive. Like that's one of the best feelings, is like having a young reader come to you specifically at a convention.
Absolutely. And like, the kids aren't the problems. It's the adults. That's my mantra. That's always
100%,
my mantra.
100%.
The kids, yeah, they're not causing the trouble. It's when you bring the grown-ups into the room that the real trouble starts.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's put a pin in that. Let's go ahead and transition to our interview for this week. This is going to be a little bit different. We're thinking outside the box here. We're redefining a little bit what community means and what our community entails and how big it gets. Our circle is bigger this week, and the person that I interviewed for this one was actually the very first interview that I did in anticipation of starting this podcast. And I've had this in my pocket since October, and I met this person at the Michigan Library Association annual conference this year. She really is a perfect example of how you make your community and your circle bigger, and how you get out of your silo, your small circle that we live in from day to day, and how we expand that, and how we include a wider range of people around us. She has a great story of doing exactly that, of thinking of outside the box in her community. Our guest today is actually the library director for the Traverse Area District Library System, Michelle Howard. So thank you very much for Michelle for being my very first interview. Thank you so much for joining me for this. So tell me who you are and where we can find you.
I am Michelle Howard, and I am the library director at the Traverse Area District Library in Traverse City, Michigan. We have one of the most unusual systems in the state, where we have the main library, we have two branch libraries, and then we have three member libraries that all have their own boards and own directors.
Oh, wow. Okay, that sounds complicated.
It is so complicated. We kind of all follow the same rules, but not always.
Okay.
And the main library acts basically as the fiduciary, and we give them money every year.
Okay.
And then they spend it how they want.
Okay.
But we have a shared ILS.
Which doesn't mean a whole lot to most communities,
but
it means that we keep all of our books in a logical place together.
Yes. Okay. And basically patrons can go to any of the six locations, and they have no idea about the structure behind it. They just can use their card at any of them, and that's perfect.
It's the beauty behind the curtain. As long as it works, that's all that matters.
Exactly.
your library has experienced in recent times a very different kind of challenge that maybe someone wouldn't necessarily associate with libraries, and that your infrastructure sort of wasn't prepared to handle initially. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened with your library?
We had a evening shelter for unhoused individuals open about 2 blocks from the library. And while we had always had incidents in the past, we were not prepared for an over 200% increase in incidents, mm-hmm. and incidents that were more violent, that were drug related, and that were directed at staff. Threats to staff, insults to staff. And what we ended up seeing is that our regular patrons telling us and telling other places like our branches and members that they won't come to our main library anymore because they don't feel safe. So we had to do something. We were trained in empathy-based training. We tried our best to be nice and to be kind to people. But in the end, we, meaning me, and luckily the board decided that something had to be done. So we started to contract with a security company. So we had security personnel in the library. We changed our policies to be less lenient because we found out people were taking advantage of that leniency. And then our board wrote a letter to the community asking for help.
So to step back a little bit, can you tell us a little bit more about what your staff was experiencing, what sort of incidents they had to grapple with, and how they handled that, how it affected them?
Mm-hmm. So I think, too, I should say that we're in northern Michigan and it's cold. And the day shelter closes at 8 a.m. and they kick everybody out. The night shelter closes at 8 a.m. They kick everybody out and they just have to find a place to be until it opens back up at about 5:45 at night. And a lot of our services has closed due to the pandemic. So places they used to stay warm, like the bus terminal, were closed. So there was really no place for them to go but the library. So what we saw was bodily fluids that we had not really seen before. People coming in, eating, just leaving garbage all over. And then when the staff would ask them to clean up, you know, being verbally assaulted, people having sex in our bathrooms, people doing drugs in our bathrooms, mm-hmm. people selling drugs, people passed out drunk. So staff would try to wake them up and they would just be greeted by a barrage of swear words. Mm-hmm. It was just like that day after day, hour after hour in the library, because a lot of these people have trauma and they also hadn't probably been to a library before and didn't really understand the rules. And they really couldn't understand why we wouldn't allow drugs and alcohol in the library. Or at least that's what they told us.
Right.
So it was really hard. I was the same because I tend to handle a lot of them because I'm the director. I'm the only one who can suspend somebody. Mm-hmm. So every day I dreaded coming into work because I didn't know what was going to happen that day. I had someone verbally assault me and then threaten to take my life because him and his girlfriend were in the bathroom together and I was kicking them out and they didn't like it. So it was those types of things day after day. It just wore us down.
Yeah, that's understandable. And that's obviously well beyond what your average library staff member is prepared for. We're not really trained for it. I know you brought this to your board when you sort of hit your breaking point. And there is one particular board member that it really resonated with. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. So I have a board of like a lot of retired educators. And she's one of our newest board members. Mary Lee Pekeser is a nurse practitioner, and she currently works in the jails, doing healthcare for the jails. And so when she heard about, you know, someone standing up and urinating in the middle of our lobby and all the other stuff, she sees that every day. Mm-hmm. But she's trained on that.
Right.
And that's what she said is like listening to my voice. The other thing with nursing is they talk a lot about moral distress. And that's where a person feels like they want to make a change, but they can't.
Right.
And that's what a lot of our staff was feeling is moral distress because we wanted to help people. But this is not a problem that just a librarian being nice can fix. This is
right.
a societal problem. And other people have to help. It just couldn't be us. And we couldn't, you know, for her, she couldn't watch the library go into a place where nobody wants to come in. And that really resonated with her and her experience in the jails. And she had worked with patients with addiction. And so she just knew something had to be done. And she was the one who said, we're not going to be the board that sits and just goes, oh, I'm sorry, Michelle. We're going to do something. And that's how the letter came about.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about the letter that you all put together and what it contained and then what you did with the letter once you completed it?
Sure. So the letter basically told people what was happening in the library because most people didn't know. Unless you came into the main library, you didn't see it. And so it first informed the community about the violence towards staff and the situation of drugs and alcohol in the library. So we addressed that, what was happening with our staff. And then it asked the community to respond. It asked for people to come together to form a coalition to help people who are unhoused. We can't do it at the library. We need a day shelter. We didn't have a day shelter. We had a night shelter. It asked the Traverse City Police Department to assign a community officer specifically to our area. And third was that people would look at opening a day shelter. There's a lot more details to the letter. But basically, we called the community out to say, this is not a problem we can fix, but this is a problem we're having to address. Let's try to fix this together. Mm-hmm. So we sent it to all the churches, all the municipal governments, townships, county, city, and we did press releases. So we had news crews in the library and we had reporters from the newspaper coming in because really a lot of people didn't know how bad it was.
Right, right. That was one thing that struck me when you were talking about the letter, what an essential component of it was that it wasn't trying to put a nice face on it. It was to make it clear and not candy coat. This was a real issue that you couldn't sweep under the rug anymore and that it really required community participation. Can you speak a little bit about how you put together collaborations with the other community organizations, how that all came together?
Yeah, so it worked out great that people just stepped up. So there was a church that had a day shelter before the pandemic and they had closed and they stepped up and said, you know what, we're going to open our day shelter, but we need help finding money. The evening shelter said, you know what, we're going to open on weekends. We didn't realize, even though I think some of them did realize, I think they also just, it's hard. They're mm-hmm. nonprofits.
Yeah.
It's hard to find money. It's hard to find volunteers to help keep people warm. But they said, we're going to step up. It's not right for this to happen to the library. The city government stepped up, city of Traverse City. Our county did not. But the city of Traverse City said, you know, we've got ARPA funds. Let's try to use that money for the shelter. And then the biggest thing was the police department had been thinking about a social worker. So they assigned a community police officer to our area where the shelter is, where we are, and where the new day shelter would be. And they hired a social worker. So now when they are confronted with someone who's having trouble, alcohol, addiction, not only does a police officer show up, but sometimes a police officer steps away and the social worker steps in to try to get that person those resources they need.
Can you provide a little bit more about, for people who might not be aware, mm-hmm. what a social worker can do in those situations?
Sure. So the social worker was someone who was already established in our community. And they know the community resources. So we, at one point, had a young family coming to the library every day. We found out they were unhoused. The social worker could meet with them, help them fill out the forms, mm-hmm. help them apply for different types of financial resources, food resources, you know, all these things. It really is a guide to helping people connect to those resources that are out there that they might not know and might not even know to ask. And so that's not really anything the library staff is trained in. The social worker also helped talk to our staff that was so stressed out.
Right.
You know, and they just give you ideas for how to take care of yourself. You know, I gave journals to all of our leadership committee to try to help people like write down what you're feeling, meet with our social worker. But they really are a liaison between the person and the state that they're in and what services are available. And they can even de-escalate. You know, we had a patron show up for months in hospital. They had been brought there by ambulance. They didn't know how they were getting home. Uh-huh. You know, the hospital kind of released them and they somehow made their way from the hospital to the library, which is about a mile. And they were just hanging out in the library all day. Well, we called the social worker who showed up, who found out what was happening, how we can get them back to their home, which was an hour away. And it was a success. That person spent one night in the evening shelter and then got a ride home. Mm-hmm. So these are the things the social workers can do that really, really make a big impact on the community.
Right. I feel like that is a really nice bridge for, especially because I think for a lot of people, with anything related to people who are unhoused, I think for a lot of people, it's like, it's just such a big issue. And there's so many factors mm-hmm. that it's easy for people to feel like they just don't want to deal with it. And especially when it comes to addiction, there's a blame that comes into the equation. And then people have a harder time finding empathy. And
yep.
And it seems to me that it's almost easier to try to sidestep the empathy issue and just come at it from a more practical angle like that, and recognize that there are people who are better equipped to handle these things, and that there can be a practical value to having that as a resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think empathy only goes so far.
Yeah.
And
it's exhausting.
It is exhausting.
It's hard to have the amount of empathy that, you know, day-to-day life even can require sometimes.
And sometimes your patrons don't remember your empathy from the day before because they were intoxicated or over, yes, you know, or yes, really high. And so they just come in the next day and they're like, what do you mean I was a jerk? And I was, you know.
Right. These are people with real health issues,
yes,
that significantly impact how, yeah, they behave, and they feel unsafe a lot of the time, yeah, as well. To what extent do you think this situation is unique to your community? How much do you think people in other communities should be aware that these things are potentially happening in their own backyard?
I think homelessness is in a lot of places, and addiction is absolutely in a lot of places. It's just nobody wants to talk about it.
Right.
If you open your eyes to it, then you'll see it is there. I think unlike Traverse City, where it tends to be a hub of people coming to Traverse City, and we have resources. There's a lot of communities that don't have any resources.
Right.
And so I think they're a little bit more hidden. But if you talk to your healthcare workers, if you talk to your police, there's probably people living in their cars all over. You know, and the more we can talk about it, the more people might recognize what's going on and try to form these coalitions that can actually help people.
So do you have any recommendations for a community trying to have this conversation before you reach that breaking point?
Yeah.
Where do you think a good place to start for something like that would be?
Well, and I think the library is a great place.
Yeah.
You know, hold a community forum, have a panel, invite your school social workers, because we know there's tons of homeless kids out there that are couch surfers.
Right.
Invite your police, invite your school social workers, invite your churches. You know, because I think they do a lot of care. A lot of churches have food pantries, and mm-hmm. they see that point of contact. Oh, wow, that person's car suddenly has all their stuff in it.
Right.
They're homeless. They're sleeping, you know. And I think though it's a good place to start to just have that conversation. And I think the biggest thing, especially with addiction, is, you know, inviting any sort of medical professionals to deal with it, mm-hmm. because it's that stigma that kills people. When you're hiding your addiction away, people die.
Right.
If we can talk about it, it just breaks down that stigma that it's someone else's problem, or, you know, they're losers. That's why they have addiction. And so having those community conversations, I think, will help bring it up so people realize, oh, it is a problem. And mm-hmm. maybe we can help, you know, instead of like having people hide their problems away, if we can help, like, that's a win for everyone.
Right. I do agree that that even having that acknowledgement is huge, because it's so easy to get bogged down in the why, and it can be very restrictive to actually accomplishing anything,
mm-hmm.
because I mean, maybe you can go back and think about the why later, but for right now, let's just try to figure out,
yeah,
how to make this no longer or less of an issue than it is currently, how to make the day-to-day a little more doable.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will, if you relate it as if like you broke your leg, right? If you broke your leg, you would go to the hospital, they would fix your leg. They might say, "What? How did you do this?" And you could say, "Oh, I, you know, fell off the stairs," but they would never shame you.
Right.
Like, they wouldn't call the police on you. They would fix your leg.
Right.
Where if a person overdoses or has an infection due to drug use, they go to the hospital, they're sick, they need to be cured, you know, And instead of getting care, they say, why do you do this? They're shamed. And then the police are called.
Right.
You know, so I think opening this conversation to our communities about homelessness and drugs and addiction can actually get people help.
I'm going to ask you a couple of fun questions, too. I know that this is a very intense topic, and I'm really grateful for your viewpoint on it, because it's so great seeing a community that has seen progress. And obviously, it's not a perfect situation. Obviously, there's still some other struggles that you are encountering, and it's an ongoing fight. But knowing that it's possible to make that progress is definitely reassuring. I think especially for people in our profession, but I think those of us mm-hmm. who do observe from day to day that there are people that are struggling with this.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's like good to just the library or just anyone who cares can be that facilitator to get people to work together. Because with our day shelter now, the police are seeing less incidents at the library, less incidents overall. People That's are great. Being connected to resources. They have a place to go to stay warm. Mm-hmm. And it's helped the police. It's helped our community. It's helped the people who are unhoused. So you just got to be able to stand up and say, hey, I want to do it.
Right.
And that's hard.
All of us don't want this to be happening in the community. It's just trying to meet in a common ground. And and that's fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. Fun questions.
Fun questions.
I'm ready.
What are you excited about in your library right now?
Oh my God. There's so many.
I know that's a hard question to answer. What are you most excited about?
This is kind of random, but we got 3D printers about 4 years ago, and our 3D printing service has gone like off the charts. It's just a fun service. We've added three new 3D printers. We've got a bigger 3D printer plate. We have a resin 3D printer now that can print things like in more fine detail. We just added a 3D scanner.
I know.
So people, what would happen is they'd like a part would break on their like old boat, let's say. Uh-huh. And they would have the part that wasn't broken, but to CAD design that was a lot of work.
Right.
And so what we do is we now have a 3D scanner. So you put it on the scanner, the cameras take, you know, a 360 view of that, and then sends it to the printer and prints it.
That is so cool.
It is so cool. And it's just one of those unexpected things that you can get at your local library. And so we're just really busy. We're adding, hopefully, if the board approves the budget, we'll be adding a staff member to help support our 3D printing service and just like the whole library of things and makerspace idea in our library, because there's a need. And it's really cool.
Yeah, that sounds really like
it's pretty cool.
There, when we get to play with cool new toys like that,
and then
share them, I feel like that's the part of us that played librarians as kids. Like, it gets to indulge that side of us, which is fantastic.
Yes.
So, in this hypothetical scenario, you've been sent to the library principal's office. Let's pretend that's a thing, and let's pretend you're not the principal in this case.
Okay, okay.
So, what did you get sent to the principal's office for?
Oh, I am the worst about returning books. That's why I would have so many fines, even though I come there every day. Like, I never check out any materials at the library that have fines, because I would totally have to pay so many fines. I'm the worst, but I think a lot of librarians are.
Yes, I think there's something about being in the library every day that makes it be like it's less of an event. It's more of a continuous experience. Whereas, I keep telling people this too, because I have two young kids, that I have to really be purposeful to get my children in the library and give them that experience, because mom and dad both work at the library. So we bring home materials, but like so much of it is that experience at that age.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we're all guilty of that.
We're all guilty. I've wrecked books in my bathtub. You know, I'm
in
like,
the
I know why, you know, if you say like, I don't even have a very good bathtub, but sometimes I just want to sit in there, read, and you're like, you know, it's just like, oh, I'll just pay for that.
Yeah.
You know, like
it happens to everybody.
It is the challenge.
Even librarians.
Yes. The struggle is real, because you just want to read everywhere.
Right. Yeah. Yes. What's the most bizarre fashion trend you've ever rocked?
Bizarre. Well, I am a child of the, I was a teenager in the 80s. So I went from super big 80s bangs to suddenly liking punk music, and I kind of like dyed my hair reddish black for a while, which I went to Catholic girls school. They frowned. They didn't let down like, the coloring. Yeah. My younger sister shaved her head, and that was super bad. She had to wear a wig for a while. But mine was just colored, and I just wore a lot of black and a lot of black makeup, you know.
I mean, in the 80s, it could have been a lot worse.
Could have been worse. Well, and yeah. Especially because I went from like the polo shirt girl to like the black girl when it has like polos and all that stuff at 14. And then at 15, I'm like, no. And
What are you talking about? I've always been punk.
I know. Exactly. No, I was never preppy.
I was born punk.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe, yeah. So either fashion, those are probably the weirdest fashion trends I've ever, like, I don't know, but everybody was doing it. I mean,
right?
There's punk rockers everywhere.
That's the 80s. The fun thing about that mentality is, especially when you're a teenager, is like you think you're rebelling, but you're surrounded by people who are all rebelling in the exact same way.
Yeah. Like, I dated a guy who had a mohawk. You know, I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, I bet mom loved that.
Oh, yeah. Mom and dad were just like, you know. And, you know, he had the mohawk and the chains and all that. And I thought he was so cute. So I tried to match his style, you know. But, yeah. Unfortunately, I don't even have any pictures from that time.
Oh, that's tragic.
I know.
That is tragic.
Such a good time of my life.
Thank you so much for sitting down with me and making the time to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad we could connect.
Me too. One of the things that is really interesting to me at these kinds of events is the fact that we get to see all of the ways in which our lives are similar and our communities are similar. Even in the state of Michigan, it's a big state and it's very easy to find very different kinds of communities. We do share a lot. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
When I've been to the ALA convention, it's the American Library Association. It's a national convention. It moves around every year. It covers the full breadth of anything related to libraries. So every corner of that world. So it's huge. It starts on Thursday and it goes through Tuesday.
Yeah.
And by the time Monday morning comes around and everybody's frantically, because they also have a post office on site.
I'm sure
people can ship stuff back because
you're getting all the arcs and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
That's my favorite part of going to ALA is Friday night is when they open the exhibition floor and it's only available to people who have full registration for the event. And it's just a mad dash. I brought a cart with me this past year and I still was that person who kept crashing into people.
That's San Diego Comic Con. As soon as those doors open. That's the one nice thing about being professional at those events.
You get in early.
Get in early. And like, even if I don't necessarily want to pick like at conventions like San Diego and everything else, people are dashing in and going straight to like Funko Pop. And getting the like limited collect releases and stuff like that. I'm not interested in doing all of that, but you know, I still want this that I know are going to be popular. Yeah, because it gets worse.
Yeah, and at ALA, all of the major publishers, they just put stacks of stuff that they have coming out in the coming like just mountains of it. They just step back and they just let people grab stuff and. It is, but it's so much fun though. It's so much fun. I usually will end up with probably a good 100 books the first night. And that's, I probably would end up with more if I could carry more, but they give out tote bags too. But you know what? When you've got 6 tote bags full of books, it's hard.
And Black Canary came out with Meg Cabot. Mm-hmm. I bagged DC to let me do ALA and stuff. And I never got a chance, but I'm like, someday I'll do ALA.
I mean, come on, DC, get it together. People want to meet the artists too.
That was the one bummer thing about that YA line that they did. I loved doing it. I loved working with Meg. But with all of their books across the board for that line, they were very focused on promoting the writers, which is fair because that was the big draw for them was getting these big name writers like Hem Garcia and that. And then the artists are like tiny little blurs in the corner.
They're definitely selling it on the on the writers. Yeah. But I mean, I've seen some of them do a little bit better about that. Maybe not necessarily the core group of them, but I can't remember what book they were promoting, but there was a graphic title that Jason Reynolds had written at this past year, and the artist, which I will fully admit I don't remember their name.
It's a lot to keep track of.
Well, I'm just bad with names in general, but I was admittedly also in line, so I could, you know, drool over Jason Reynolds,
right?
Because he's the coolest in the world. But yeah, like I do feel like some of the non-DC Marvel publishers are maybe just a little bit better about
that. Yeah, for sure.
And their boots are actually pretty small at those events too. I think they are such a known quantity that like it's a little bit like, yeah, we're here. I mean, you know, we're here. Whereas you've got Scholastic that's got, if you look at the map, they're just like 12 booths all. It's insane.
So it's the inverse of San Diego, where like, because Scholastic and like Random House and all those other publishers have booths at San Diego Comic Con, but they're like,
right. They're the minority in that space. Yeah.
Meanwhile, Marvel has this huge stage and like,
right.
Usually an exhibit. I once did a signing. I think I was at Boom doing a signing over the Garden Wall.
I love Boom Studios. I will happily buy every single title that they put out.
They're awesome. They do put out great stuff. But this one year, I was doing a signing at their table. San Diego was, the booth was right across from the Marvel.
That's a rough place to be.
It was a rough place to be, especially because during the same time I was signing, they had the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy right across from me.
Oh, okay.
So I was just like staring at like Zoe
Zell. Well, I mean, aisle, if you're like, going to stare at somebody.
Exactly. Nobody's at my table. They're all looking at Chris Pratt. And I'm like, well, all right.
I'll pick Zoe over Chris Pratt. Like, he's okay.
I'm trying to think. Was it? My God, I can't think of his name. Lee Pace. I think Lee Pace was there.
Oh, okay. Oh,
what a beautiful man. That was another thing I used to do at San Diego Comic-Con before I really started doing my comics and stuff was, for a while, I was going as media.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do interviews and stuff. Like, news clips and stuff. So I got to interview celebrities every so often.
Oh, fun. Who was the most fun person you ever got to interview?
Probably one of the nicest and chillest guys who, like, every time you talk to him, you can just feel how excited he is to be making movies was Bro.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Coolest guy.
Yeah.
I think that one stands up most.
And he makes some pretty remarkable stuff, too. He obviously gets to execute his creative vision a lot more clearly than some people in that industry. So I'm sure it's nice to be him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's kind of got me. Yeah, he's kind of got like that blank check to do whatever. But.
So we've talked a lot about the more glamorous side of, of comic. So do you want to talk a little bit about what that world looks like to you on a more day-to-day? What's a day in the life of a comic artist, of a freelance comic artist?
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's going to vary from title to title. Like, I'm working on two different book titles right now. One I've contracted for a while now, and neither of these have been announced, so I can't say what they are, but the one that I've had has been great because it's like a full-length graphic novel, and they've been very good about letting me take my time on it because I was suffering from like burnout last year. So
freelancing, I can imagine. Like, you, I'm extrapolating here. To be fair, I have friends who have worked as creative freelancers before. I'm sure there's a little bit of like, I need to ride this wave while I can.
Yep.
So it doesn't crest and disappear. So
exactly,
I can chase totally see that. Yeah.
Basically. So yeah, the one book has been great because I can take my time. I'll do like chunks of rough sketches of each page at a time and send them in for approval from the editors and writers and wait for those before I go in and do meter pencils and then get a pass for those and then move on to the ink, the final.
Okay.
They send it to somebody else for coloring.
Okay.
Color and lettering because I like to color, but colorists in comics don't get enough credit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh my gosh, that coloring will 9 times out of 10 carry entire. Like, it will make all.
Yeah.
And I've worked with some colorists, so I'm excited to see what we do with these books.
It's funny to think that so much of that creatively, you know, lives and dies with you, but then at the end of the day, there's this very final product that you're kind of just sending out. And
it's fun to see what it looks like when you get it back. The inverse of that nice, long, like, relaxed book that I've got doing, I got a call from Marvel a couple of weeks ago, and they needed just a fill-in artist. Very, very tight deadline. The pages were actually due yesterday, but I emailed and I was like, because I had 2 weeks to do an issue, where usually that you'll get like at least a month or two on an issue. And so
does that mean that because you're filling in for like established artwork, does that mean you have to basically imitate an existing style?
Or? For this, luckily, no. Okay. Sometimes I'll ask artists to do that. There are artists that specifically are hired because they're that kind of thing. Uh-huh. I am not one of those artists.
Yeah, that would be tough, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's a very precise skill that I do not have. When I was in college and in my 20s, I could definitely knock out a whole issue in a week or two. No problem, whatever. I'm learning now as I approach 40 that I cannot do that so much anymore. I'll get to about midnight and I'm like, oh, I need to go to bed, but I still have like 3 pages I have to ink tonight. So the last week or so, I've pretty much been running on like Red Bull and determination.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a lot. It's definitely a lot. And then, well, the nice thing too is it's not, this project is not a traditional issue, like a physical book. It's their web form.
Right.
So it's the scrolling webtoon format. So it's not really broken into pages so much as like screens. Uh-huh. So it's technically a little bit shorter than a traditional issue would be, but with the web format, it's interesting because you have to think about it in a completely different way.
Oh, yeah.
Because usually I'm thinking about like how page turns will look and like the pacing of like when you're looking at the page. Uh-huh. And with scrolling web format, I have to be thinking about how you're reading your phone and like what's happening.
How much is visible in a panel on the screen,
And with this issue, too, in particular, I'll have to, like, show you when it comes out, because a lot of it heavily relies on the narrative of scrolling down. Like, there's like, a character is falling out of an airplane issue. So it's just her
Oh, that's fascinating. Falling. What an interesting idea. Okay.
So it's been an interesting challenge. So it's luckily, again, like, since the deadline's so tight, I have very little I have to draw in terms of, like, environments, which is usually the hardest part, is, like, drawing intricate grounds and stuff.
Right, right.
This, I'm like, no, it's everywhere. So that's like, it's got to get done.
And this, to me, just underscores that much more. Like, I tend to get on the soapbox when it comes to stuff like this, especially with parents. A lot of parents are starting to get it, but, like, there is still so much stigma with adults who were, you know, who grew up before this was a format that people were familiar with. And now, especially as is informed by like what the standards are set in the schools, there's very like, well, you know, comic reading is extra reading, but then we do the real reading in the classroom, and real reading apparently doesn't have visuals. I don't know why, which is so counterintuitive because they read picture books forever. So I don't know why, why suddenly that becomes stigmatized. It really links back to that concept that like there are multiple forms of literacy. There's what we think of in terms of like reading sentences on a page and fluency of language and all that and everything that we learn in schools from that aspect. But visual literacy is very important.
Oh yeah.
Like it fires things in your brain.
Yep.
If kids do not learn that, it can alter how they experience things, too.
For sure.
And if you want your kid to be like an engineer later on, they need to be able to visually and spatially process things. And that's something that gets underscored by that sort of experience.
Exactly. So. If you have like one of the most famous comic book illustrators of all time, Will Eisner, the Oscars of comics are named after him because he was so influential, and he did like I'm not going to be able to think of Contract with God and The Spirit and all of these really amazing comic titles that read like literature.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, you know, you talk about engineering. He used to illustrate the mechanic manuals for the Army during mm-hmm. World War II and stuff. And so he has that range of being able to do comics, but also these detailed, like, beautiful, honestly, right. like, mechanical and- illustrations. And so, like, yeah, you can't just, like, it's easy to lump all, like, comic art together, but it's so broad. And, like, yeah, it's fascinating, honestly, mm-hmm. when you really look into it.
We should culturally give that a lot more credit. I think there's this goofy assumption that because it's not something that you quote unquote learn to do, that it doesn't have the same value. There are things that your brain is doing that you don't even know it's doing, but you still want them to do it. Like yeah. you want your brain to be able, and really phenomenal artists, part of what they do is they break down how a person is going to, how to take this in, how they're going to perceive it, what's going to catch the eye first and mm-hmm. like, yeah, and how you take it in. And they, you know, they use that to their advantage. And
that's the biggest part of my job as a comic artist is making sure I can very clearly demonstrate what the writer wants to show in a comic page and like make sure that the reader can understand what's going on. Like I'll get comic scripts that are like, it'll be frustrating because the script will say something like, in this panel, character turns around and sees so-and-so and then jumps out of the window. I'm like, oh no, that's like five panels that I have to draw because that's more than one action and right, more than one right. person. And if I try to cram so much information into just one panel, the reader's not going to know what the heck is going right, on. Right. Nobody's
pacing is huge. Yeah.
Exactly. There's a lot more thought that goes into the layout of a page than a lot of people realize.
And just to put in a plug, you are doing a program for our teenage group in April, talking about
a lot of this stuff. Honestly, yeah. I want to like show teenagers pretty much the process of what goes into making a page, like mm-hmm. from getting the script to like breaking it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll try to cram as much information in there as I can.
Hey, and if this is a subject that interests you and you are not a teen, definitely let us know. Cause, as I said, we're comic nerds here too. I'm sure like we would happily let her do a whole session with just the staff and not invite anybody else.
Uh-huh.
If it's something that you would like to hear more about beyond the lengthy conversations we keep having, because why not? Let us know, because I think it would be fun for us to do more programming around this. As long as we can keep her in the building, we might as well take advantage of her, right?
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much, Kara, for sitting down with me. And as I so often do, I just put you on the spot and made you sit down with me impromptu. So thank you for being so open and understanding about
always.
That. Have fun at Emerald City. Hopefully your flight doesn't get canceled and everything goes smoothly, and hopefully you don't have a gigantic migraine at the end of the weekend, but
knock on wood.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
So, all right. Take care.